Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad arrived in New York for a meeting at the United Nations, which had much of the media in a frenzy. But does the debate over free speech and Ahmadinejad's criticism of the United States steer us away from more important matters, like whether the U.S. is planning military action against Iran? We'll speak with Baruch College history professor Yervand Abrahamian. Also on Counterspin today, in 2006, most military experts placed the strength of al-Qaeda in Iraq at 3-5% of the insurgency. But 2007 saw the estimates of the al-Qaeda menace in Iraq grow, along with George Bush's attempts to cast al-Qaeda as the U.S.'s chief foe in Iraq. For the real story of al-Qaeda in Iraq, we'll talk to Andrew Tillman, former Stars and Stripes reporter and author of the Washington Monthly report, The Myth of al-Qaeda in Iraq. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
There were plenty of postmortems in the media on the failure of Senate Democrats to come up with any Iraq war resolutions that would attract more than a few Republican votes. Attention thus turned back to the liberal group MoveOn.org, whose anti-David Petraeus newspaper ad gave a chance for Republicans and many pundits to talk about something other than, well, the actual war in Iraq. In one report, NBC anchor Brian Williams called MoveOn a special interest group, a label the media tend to reserve for groups of people who have bullied their way into politics, never mind that they represent millions of citizens. But that designation was kind compared to a September 23rd article in the New York Times by Matt Bai, which managed to reveal plenty about the author's view of the world when he wrote that 6 months after Mr. Bush's re-election in 2004, quote, opposition to the Iraq war suddenly seemed to be breaking out like a rash around the country, close quote. First of all, opposition to the war started, and it was in a way strongest, before the war began. Pretending that it came about in early 2005 is just bizarre. But the fact that a Times reporter would liken war opposition to a rash is perhaps the most revealing part. When's the last time you've heard someone speak about a rash in a positive context? Next time peace marchers wonder why their efforts get so little attention in the press, it might be worth remembering that some reporters view anti-war activism as something that needs to be treated.
The initial draft of a bill before Congress earlier this year would have given the FDA authority to block drug companies from advertising medications with serious safety concerns. That sounds reasonable enough, but when the legislation finally passed, the provision was gone, thanks in part to the media industry entering the debate on the side of pharmaceutical companies. According to a probing September 21st Wall Street Journal report, when it looked like the bill would be passed with the restrictions, the National Association of Broadcasters stepped in to lend some lobbying muscle to the pharmaceutical companies. As the Journal explained, in 2006, drug companies, quote, registered the highest growth rate among the top 10 U.S. advertisers, close quote, in large part because drug ads are one of the industry's, quote, most powerful sales-boosting tools, close quote. The broadcast industry's interest in the bill is clear. Big media are the recipient of much of the $150 billion that pharmaceutical companies spend each year on advertising. And so it was that restrictions that would have protected the public health were, according to the Journal, left on the cutting room floor, along with the notion that our media industry looks out for the public interest. Well, it goes without saying that the story of big lobbyists killing unfriendly legislation was not something many media outlets were eager to share with viewers. It might make them think twice about what all those drug advertisements are really buying.
Do peace negotiations cause violence? A recent Wall Street Journal article on what the paper dubbed the first substantive Israeli-Palestinian negotiations in 7 years offered readers a brief and inaccurate history lesson about the collapse of the negotiations 7 years prior. Following the Camp David summit in 2000, the Journal wrote that, quote, Palestinian militants launched suicide bombings inside Israel, close quote. The paper echoed the claims of Israeli officials who seem alarmed at the quiet they're experiencing now, quote, even the calm in Israel has heightened the sense of extreme caution surrounding the talks. Israeli officials remind that when the two sides tried to achieve too much progress too fast in 2000, the Second Intifada was born, close quote. While this may be the media's preferred version of history, it happens to be misleading. In reality, there was relative calm in the occupied occupied territories for the 2 months following Camp David, despite the fact that Israel stepped up the construction of illegal settlements, demolished Palestinian houses in East Jerusalem, and expropriated the property of Arab residents to build a new Jewish-only highway. The Intifada did not begin until September 29th of that year, when Israeli troops opened fire on unarmed Palestinian rock throwers in Jerusalem, killing 4 and wounding over 200, and sparking demonstrations throughout the territories. Israel may very well want to send the message that trying too hard to make peace leads to violence, but that doesn't make it true.
On September 24th, the Treasury Department came out with a report on Social Security claiming that the program was $13 trillion in the red and that benefit cuts and/or tax increases were necessary to make it solvent. There's another view of this, one familiar to longtime listeners to Counterspin, that Social Security is currently taking in much more money than it pays out, that it's now got a surplus that will last for decades, and that predictions of an eventual shortfall are based on extremely pessimistic estimates of future growth. But if you read about the report in the September 24th Associated Press Dispatch, as no doubt most newspaper readers did, you wouldn't have seen any of that because AP chose to quote no one outside the Bush administration on the report. In addition to the report itself, AP quoted Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, one of Paulson's assistant secretaries, and then, for balance, White House spokesperson Tony Fratto. CBS News anchor Katie Couric summed up the story in a September 24th news brief, quote, "Treasury says the only answer is to cut benefits and/or raise taxes. The White House said President Bush remains opposed to raising taxes," close quote. There you have it, the allowable debate on Social Security in the mainstream media.
And finally, women feed the jump in college enrollment. That was the headline on a September 12th USA Today story. That was straightforward enough, as was the news itself. Census data show an increase in the number of both male and female students at colleges and universities. And women, in 2006, made up 56% of undergrads, up from 55% in 2000. Not at all straightforward, though, was USA Today's bizarre cast on the story. The article refers throughout to the problem of women outnumbering men on campus, taking its tone from its only source, a psychologist named Leonard Sachs, who pushes the notion that any female advancement comes at a cost to men. The numbers, readers learn, are disturbing to Sachs, because they indicate a lack of drive on the part of boys that Sachs traces to faulty early education. We now have second-grade boys who will tell you they hate school, Sachs claims, in the apparent belief that this is a phenomenon previously unknown. Despite having just the one source, it seems to have occurred to USA Today that if it makes sense to presume a zero-sum game in education, such that you find in any numerical gain by women a newsworthy loss for men, then they'd best get to work on these sheafs of pages they'll need to write about all of the various fields and industries in which men outnumber women, presumably, if we're to be consistent, at the expense of women. We'll be on the lookout for that.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. FAIR also publishes a magazine called Extra. I'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the program.
The arrival of Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in New York could have been a rather low-key affair. World leaders, after all, routinely visit the UN for these General Assembly meetings. But Iran's place in the White House's axis of evil created the perfect conditions for a media frenzy, with the local New York tabloids trying to outdo each other to inflame the situation. To give you some flavor, the New York Daily News had "The Evil Has Landed" on its cover. The more respectable media weren't going that far, but does this relentless focus on Ahmadinejad actually tell us anything about Iran? Or does all this serve other interests? Joining us now to talk about this is Yervand Abrahamian. He is a distinguished professor of history at Baruch College and the co-author of Inventing the Axis of Evil. Yervand Abrahamian, welcome to Counterspin.
Good morning. Hi.
Now, the spectacle at the UN and then at Columbia University made news across the country. There weren't many surprises in all this. His visit angered his critics. His most bizarre or reactionary comments were bolded and underlined and highlighted. And then it seemed to be over, more or less. Do you think this was a sideshow? And if it was, whose interests are being served by this kind of media attention?
Well, I think there's a mutual interest. On the right wing here is an interest because they're eager to demonize Iran as preparing the public for eventual airstrikes on the country. So it's I think it plays into their hands. And it also plays, ironically, into the hands of the right wing in Iran because they want to strengthen their position in the Iranian electorate because there is an election coming up next year and Ahmadinejad needs to strengthen his base, which is actually quite small, but he can't win an election with just the base. He needs to expand it. And the more publicity he gets, even if it's bad in the United States, this actually plays into his electoral scheme.
So the president of Columbia University dressing him down in public actually does him a favor in a way in Iran?
Oh, great favor. I mean, this is for him wonderful because it not only shows the disrespect of the America to the president of Iran. So even Iranians who don't like their own president, when they see their president in a way insulted like that, they tend to obviously to sympathize with their president.
What about this notion that we're misperceiving Iranian politics, that Ahmadinejad actually isn't all that powerful in Iranian society or in their political structure?
He's not at all powerful. In fact, one of the big, I think, blunders of President Bollinger was to call him a dictator. By no stretch of the imagination does he have dictatorial power. He doesn't have even the ability to choose his own cabinet ministers. He is basically the head of the executive, but decisions about foreign policy, internal policy are all made outside his hands. And even when you come to the nuclear issue, there's a committee appointed by the supreme leader that negotiates with the Europeans and with the United Nations. So he's not involved in there. He has a say and he can actually disrupt the process by inflammatory statements, but he is not the person who actually negotiates with the nuclear energy or with the Europeans.
Now, there are worries, and there have been for several months, that we're looking at a ramping up toward war in Iran, just like we saw a few years ago with Iraq. The parallels are striking in some ways. There are also some differences. Do you see some of the same things happening now with regard to Iran that were happening in the media before the Iraq invasion?
Yes, I think the same interest groups, especially the American Enterprise Institute, the vice president, they're basically doing a rerun of it. And part of it is to insinuate the links between Iran and terrorist activities so that it's not just the nuclear issue that gets involved. It's now become Iran involved in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in terrorist activities against the U.S. So a lot of parallels. One important difference, which is encouraging, is this time round, there seem to be more people in the military hierarchy here who are reluctant to go into war. There were, of course, people in the military before, but usually retired military who realized it would be really a disaster to invade. Someone like General Zinnib was quite blunt in forewarning that if we went into Iraq, that would be a disaster. But active military personnel tended to keep their reservations either quiet or they just went along with the decisions. This time around, I think there's more reluctance and open opposition. Admiral Fallon, for instance, seems to be very reluctant to expand the war. And Abizad, he's come out even saying that it wouldn't be disastrous if Iran had a nuclear weapon. I don't think Iran is going for a nuclear weapon, but the idea that here you have a American top generals saying that, I think indicates that there are people in the U.S. military that are willing to live with even with the nightmarish situation of Iran having a bomb.
And you see some of this conveyed in the papers now, so it does seem very different from the run-up to the Iraq war, for sure.
The problem is, of course, the bottom line is they don't make decisions. Sure. The president, the vice president makes the decision. And if they decide, these counter voices would be easily drowned out and basically overruled. So there is some hope, but I wouldn't put too much money on that.
Now, a few years ago in the book, Inventing the Axis of Evil, you wrote about the two main themes of coverage of Iran over the years: diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Iran, and then the internal struggle between more reformist elements in society there and the conservatives inside Iran. That second theme used to be much more important to U.S. media coverage of Iran. Something happened along the way where that storyline seemed to get lost. Did Iranian society really shift dramatically to the right in the last 7 or 8 years?
No, it hasn't. But I think that the more rhetoric there is from here, that strengthens Ahmadinejad. But I think people who are familiar with Iranian politics still have hope that in the next election, the reformers might make a comeback. And that, of course, would open the possibilities. But still, the final decision would be in Washington. I mean, in Iran, there was a reasonable government that was willing to negotiate for a long time, but really the obstacle was in Washington, not there. So if we, let's say, have a change of administrations in both in Washington and Tehran, it would improve the atmosphere, but it wouldn't automatically lead to negotiations because there were, I think, problems even when Clinton was in the White House before and Khatami was president in Iran.
Well, we've been speaking with Yervand Ebrahimian. He is a distinguished professor of history at Baruch College, co-author of Inventing the Axis of Evil. Thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
As 2006 was coming to a close and George Bush was claiming al-Qaeda in Iraq was responsible for most of the violence there, his charge met some pretty stiff resistance. The Iraq Study Group report concluded that al-Qaeda was only responsible for a small portion of the violence in Iraq, and Major General William Caldwell, a key U.S. military spokesman in Iraq, called al-Qaeda extremely disorganized and added, "I would question at this point how effective they are at the state level." At the same time, Jim Mikulshevsky of NBC News reported that military intelligence estimated al-Qaeda accounted for just 2-3% of enemy forces in Iraq. However, 2007 has been a different story, with White House and Pentagon claims about the strength of al-Qaeda meeting much less resistance. What's the real story about al-Qaeda in Iraq? Andrew Tillman's report on the subject, The Myth of AQI, appears in the October edition of the Washington Monthly magazine and can be read on the monthly's website. Tillman reported from Iraq for the military publication Stars and Stripes in 2005 and 2006. Andrew Tillman, welcome to Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you begin your piece by recounting an infamous attack on a Shiite marketplace in Tal Afar in March of this year, showing how the attack became widely attributed to al-Qaeda, even though you say there's good reason to doubt that. Tell us how this story is emblematic of how the story of al-Qaeda is being told here.
Well, I think it's emblematic in a number of ways. First of all, when this big news event, this big bombing in Tal Afar happened, I don't believe there were any reporters out in the city of Tal Afar or embedded with that military unit. So most of the stories were based on statements from officials in Baghdad, Iraqi officials and U.S. officials. And I think that when you look at those statements, sometimes they're hedged. They say that we believe this to be al-Qaeda, it appears to be al-Qaeda, and at some point the conversation devolves to the point where it simply is al-Qaeda. And I think that that often gains a lot of traction because the alternative explanation is one that's very complex, and it delves into Sunnis and Shias and tribal politics and regional power struggles And that's just a very difficult alternative explanation to really outline on a tight deadline.
Well, you say that the attribution to al-Qaeda in Iraq is under some question there and in many other cases. Tell us about the Tal Afar attack. How has that come under question in your view?
Well, there was talk in the immediately after the attack that this was al-Qaeda. But some other senior military officials who had worked in Tal Afar and had a real intimate knowledge of that city suggested that this was really an eruption of local violence between tensions of people that live in the city. Then after the bombing, about 2 weeks later, there was a very low-profile military press release about some arrests made, and there was no mention in that press release that these arrests, these suspects, were involved with al-Qaeda. And when I followed up 6 months later and I said, you know, to the military officials in the north of Iraq, what have you got on this bombing? They said that they had no further evidence, and all they could say was that it was consistent with al-Qaeda, which is sort of a strange twist of logic. You know, if it looks like it could be al-Qaeda, therefore it is al-Qaeda, I mean, it's a leap.
So it's interesting that this story began with even General Petraeus, David Petraeus, who's been in the news recently, touting it as an al-Qaeda attack. And then as time went by, more quietly, lower-level sources moved somewhat away from that view.
Yes, I mean, I think this is common in the sense that the upper-level civilian and military leaders talk, you know, they tend to simplify the situation. And the al-Qaeda explanation is one of the most intriguing things about it, and the reason why it gained so much traction is because it's intuitively simple. It, you know, it's pretty easy for an average reader or viewer or listener to think that, oh, this is a bipolar struggle between al-Qaeda and the forces of peace and democracy. It's much more difficult to convey this is a multipolar struggle between constantly shifting alliances and a very hazy situation that we're really not quite sure what it is.
Well, I want to get more into that. As mentioned last year, most experts said al-Qaeda accounted for a small number of Iraqi insurgents. In your article, you tell how this estimate has been up to 15% in military circles more recently. Similarly, the inflation of the al-Qaeda in Iraq threat has also been reflected in much reporting. As Salon's Glenn Greenwald pointed out back in June when he said that it seemed like everyone the U.S. was fighting in Iraq was al-Qaeda. Why has the al-Qaeda in Iraq threat been upgraded?
Well, I was not a part of the decision to upgrade that in terms of the rhetoric, but it was very clear that when you were watching this story very closely that earlier in 2007, all of a sudden, the military officials in Baghdad and a lot of people in the administration began to really conflate al-Qaeda with any kind of Sunni insurgent. And all of a sudden, whenever there was any kind of skirmish in a city like Bakuba, the press release indicated that U.S. forces had a firefight of some sort with al-Qaeda militants. I don't quite know why that was, but it was a very clear shift in the way military and civilian officials talked about the violence in Iraq.
Do you think it helps the White House do what they couldn't do to begin with, and that was to tie Iraq to the September 11th attacks?
I think so. I think that there's always been an effort to make that tie, and the terminology has changed. You know, initially, there was talk of there being foreign fighters in Iraq. And then there was talk of Zarqawi and the Zarqawi network in Iraq. And since Zarqawi was killed last year, that the terminology is now al-Qaeda in Iraq. But it's really the same group that they're talking about in the sense that they're trying to convey the idea that that the violence in Iraq is caused by rabble-rousing outsiders and not the indigenous Iraqis that might be very troubled by the 2003 invasion and the very profound power shifts that have followed that.
Well, you've touched on this, but you wrote in your piece, quote, "The view that al-Qaeda is neither as big nor lethal as is commonly believed is widespread among working-level analysts and troops on the ground." By this reckoning, wouldn't it be better if reporters relied on those lower-level analysts who seem to have the story down better?
It might be, but as when you're covering any beat, getting access and developing sources in those circles is more difficult than, you know, getting some straightforward statements from public affairs officials or the high-ranking people that hold the press conferences. So I think it's this is the kind of situation you see in a lot of beats. I think it's a very, very extreme situation here with Iraq.
Well, and that leads to the next question, which is that you mentioned in your piece that the press is somewhat complicit in hyping this al-Qaeda in Iraq threat. That's obviously partly how it happens, by going to these higher-level analysts and political types and getting misinformation. What else is going on there, do you think?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I mean, first of all, when you're talking about very short wire service news stories and very short broadcast news pieces, you have to simplify things. That's the construct of a lot of the journalism we do these days. And the al-Qaeda, as I said before, the al-Qaeda threat and the idea is something that is easily packaged and compartmentalized, whereas some of these other alternative explanations are really very difficult to get to, no matter how much time you have, let alone if you're trying to do this in 30 seconds. And I think that there's also an element of one of the things I noticed when I got to Iraq, one of the most telling things is that how little the reporters really move around. I mean, there was a big shift in 2004 that very few people talked about, and that's that reporters stopped driving around on their own. They basically travel with the military or they stay in a very, very confined space in central Baghdad. And I think that's one of the most telling indicators of what the reality of Iraq is. And I think there's been a reluctance for a lot of news organizations to really look at that because they're trying to project a voice of authority when they talk about Iraq, and that's kind of an uncomfortable reality.
We've been speaking with Andrew Tillman. You can read his piece, The Myth of AQI, in the October edition of Washington Monthly or on the magazine's website. Andrew Tillman, thanks for joining us on Counterspin today.
Thanks, Steve.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. Be sure to tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. You can listen to Counterspin at FAIR's website at www.fair.org. This show was engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.